From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Today, guest host OSU professor Nicole Kraft talks to Joshua Jay, OSU alumnus and speaker at this year's Young Writers Workshop Capstone event hosted by the OSU English Department, about the magic of writing. Also, OSU student Derek Palacio reviews Chris Adrian's novel, The Great Night. Stay tuned.
I'm Nicole Kraft, and I'm here with magician Joshua Jay. Welcome.
Thank you, Josh.
It's great to have you. You know, Ohio State, we graduate a lot of people with a lot of different majors who go on to a lot of careers, but not that many of them go on to careers in magic.
That's true.
So we are very excited to welcome you as an Ohio State graduate and just a renowned magician who's getting more success than I think even you could have imagined.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
So you were an English major here at Ohio State. How does someone who's an English major move off into a career in magic?
That's a good question. From the time I was really little, I never had any doubts that I would be a magician. But the deal with my parents was, gotta go to school, get a degree. We don't care in what you do it with, but you have to do something. So I like to write, I like to read, so I thought English would be okay. And contrary to what a lot of people offered as advice, they thought I should go into theater or perhaps business, help with a business degree. But I was somehow drawn to English, and I was nurtured there at a great, great set of teachers, and I loved every second of it, and it works in strange ways. I got out of school, sort of left the degree behind, and started on this performing career, and then very quickly I found that my writing served me very well. I did some writing for some television for other magicians. I then got a book deal, which has taken me all over the world. And I write for a magazine about magic and contribute to three or four other magazines. And all of this because they look at me as somebody who does magic but can also write about it and articulate the craft in, on the printed page. So it's in a roundabout way of going, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you wrote, as part of the work that you did here at Ohio State, you wrote your first magic book, right?
Yeah. So as part of the honors program, they sort of tell you, now it's time to do your thesis. Great. What do I do it on? Anything you want. So I thought there's a possibility here, because when you get into magic, maybe a lot of you at home have dabbled in magic. Most kids have. They just grow out of it when they're 12. But the way you get into magic is sort of not clear to a lot of people. Sometimes you check out a book at a library, but those books were written 60 years ago. A trick could take a paragraph. So I wanted to reinvent how magic was taught, how it was transmitted to new students, and not just little kids, but good tricks for people who wanted to take it seriously. So that was what my thesis was. It was sort of a focus on playing cards. I was living in France, I think, when I started it, and over there they have this great playing card culture with museums and stuff. And so I wrote this book and reinvented the curriculum, the way I would teach it, and it was great because I was in school, so I was learning how they roll out, you know, fiction and Bio 101 and all the classes I was taking, so I wanted the lessons to be cumulative, I wanted there to be some instant gratification, and I wrote this book. And then, fortunately, it got published.
And you wrote another book.
And I wrote another book, yeah, a general one and then one just on cards.
And now you have a third book coming out in October?
I do. It's sort of a reissue of the first book. It's called The Complete Magician. And it is a kit. It's not just a book, but it's going to have all the stuff. My publisher is Workman, and they do these fabulous books that sometimes come with stuff or clustered with things, and their books are always really beautiful, and you probably have a lot of Workman books at home. The Silver Palette Cookbook, 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. They have The Imprint That Does Water for Elephants and lots of other things, but they're always pushing me to go further, and this great book of magic is still just a book that you have to get all these things for. Mm-hmm. So they asked me to go back, and if we could give somebody a box that they could actually do a show out of, what would that be? So that's the new one.
We all, I think, have this stereotypical view of what magicians are, and an abracadabra, and you're going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. But I would imagine magic's changed a lot since you first learned about it, and now that you do it. What exactly is a magician in your view?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that's always changing. I think it's changing for the better. Magic's becoming smarter. It's becoming sleeker. The kind of magic that has become obsolete, even since I was a kid, is the box pushing, the apparatus stuff. Because let's face it, right now, we can go see Captain America. We can ditch this interview and you and I could go see Harry Potter. And that's a lot better magic tricks than a lot of what the stage guys are doing. We can't compete with those special effects. It's rendered a lot of the things that people saw at the turn of the century before TV obsolete. Mm-hmm. So how can magic compete? Well, nothing beats sleight of hand. If I borrow objects from you, that pen from you, that coin from him, and do magic in that way, that's an incredible experience. That's not something that a movie can simulate. You can't simulate it any other way. And the other way magic has changed is the internet. The internet has completely changed our industry. They just called me, Barry Gordimer just called me to do an NPR segment. They're doing one of these examinations that they do in all fields, and they're doing one on magic. And all the older talking heads in my industry all took the position that the internet was bad for magic. And they're like, you know, we're trying to get somebody to go on record and you know, say the opposite. And that's how I feel. So I was happy to go on. And what everybody is upset about is you can go on YouTube and search for a lot of the tricks you think you know, look them up, and there's somebody explaining how it's done or how they think it's done. You can go on websites and see schematics. You can go on websites and buy a lot of the tricks that you couldn't get before. Those are bad things for our industry. But there's also a lot of good. It's made a global community. Now, people can train at home in front of their computers, and the level, I sometimes train young magicians, the level of like 12, 13-year-old magicians is better than the level of a lot of 40, 50-year-old magicians was 10 years ago. They're learning at an explosive rate because of their access to media. So I'm really in favor of the good parts that magic has to offer on the net.
Is it destroying the mystique, though, for a lot of people?
Some might say that, but I'm of the opinion, you know, magic is about concealing. It's the art of concealing art. If I could juggle, I would be here right now showing you how I juggle, teaching you what I do. Mm-hmm. If we were talking about the craft of writing, you're all but happy to share the tips and tricks. Mm-hmm. But in magic, of course, I can't. I can't talk about that. I can't show you anything. And that's great, because that instills the mystery and the mystique you're talking about. But it's also very limiting, because if you could see how these things work, if you could see how many months go into developing a piece that I create, you'd see a different, even more fascinating side than the trick itself. Mm-hmm. So what I try and do in my shows is show them a little piece of that, pull back the curtain just a little bit, and let them see process. Because process, I think, is where the future of magic lies. Not how it's done, but just something about the way these tricks are conceived, the stories behind the tricks. And in that way, the internet and all of this, I don't want to say exposure, but all of this relevance that magic is, and attention that magic is getting, is good for it.
I saw one interview where you bent a card to show how people
right.
are able to determine
and
which card
they selected. And that's just taken from the cheating table, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll show you guys that later.
So how do you develop into a sleight of hand magician? I mean, as opposed to being an illusionist, even when you started, why did you go in that direction?
You take all of your social skills, throw them away, and what's left is magic. I was always drawn to close-up because, as we talked about, no frills, no misdirection, no curtains and lighting. It's just right here. It's your hands. It's like playing an instrument, jamming out. It's like riding a skateboard. A lot of it's jazzed or improvised. And that's what draws me to it. So, I mean, the way you go about it is you grab a deck of cards and you practice. And you start exploring possibilities. I don't invent moves and then figure out what to do with them. I think what we call effect-driven thinking. In other words, I think, what would be great? If I could have you sign a playing card and make it go there, that would be great. Mm-hmm. If I could have you take a coin and make it change, that would be great. And then you figure out a way to do that.
Is this social magic? I was reading something about social magic. Is that part of...
Yeah, some people call it impromptu magic. I mean, with the appearance of David Blaine on the scene, street magic took on this whole new meaning for people. You know, hey, what's up? Want to see a trick? And you just do it on the street. And I think people are... It's a very romantic notion that you can be going about your day and then just have somebody come in and change your sense of reality for a few moments. And that's a beautiful thing.
Why cards specifically? And I love the line you had that you're up to two packs a day.
But, yeah.
Why was it the cards? Is there something, I mean, there's such a natural connection between magic and cards, but why was that important for you?
One of my favorite magicians is a man named Johann Nepomuk Hofsenzer from Austria. spoke German. And he said that cards are the poetry of magic. And I think that's really true. It's sort of like a guitar for music. You know, everybody wants to play guitar because whether it's Eddie Vedder doing an acoustic set or somebody playing classical guitar in a, you know, Carnegie Hall, you can do so much with so little. So cards are my instrument. Just, I go through packs, really, in this kind of weather, you know, two tricks and I'll be done with the deck. But, you know, any deck, anywhere, hand it to me, and I can do really interesting things. I can entertain hundreds of people, and that appeals to me.
So your dad was a magician.
He was.
Talk a little bit about your relationship with him and how he helped you develop into the magician you are.
Yeah, he went to Ohio State. So he very much urged me to come here, and that was never a doubt in my mind. He wasn't a professional magician, but he had a love of magic, like many people do. I mean, what's interesting about my industry is the way it moves forward is not always by professionals, but by doctors, lawyers, dentists, waiters, accountants, people who go about their lives, but at night, when nobody else is around, they develop great tricks. They do things on an amateur level. They publish their magic so others can use it. They consult for magic. And so, in a way, our industry is driven by amateurs. And my dad was one of those amateur magicians. So he had a love for magic. And I always thought, like, so he works hard so we can come home and do magic. I want to do magic all day. That's what I want to do. And that's how it worked out.
So you're here at Ohio State with the Young Writers Workshop.
Yes.
How did that come about? What made you, I know that you'd work with Michelle Herman before.
Right.
But tell me about that invitation and what exactly it involved for you.
So she was really great. She was a big influence on me. And at one point, taking these English classes, she said, let me petition you into a grad level class because I think you'd find it challenging and interesting. And, okay, it's going to be hard. It'll be fine. So she petitioned me into a class called Literary Publishing, and she had a different writer or somebody in the industry. I think we had an agent, we had an editor of a magazine. They all came in and they spoke to us about the different sides of publishing, sort of not quite the business of writing a book, but in that direction. And we read pieces and what it's like to work with an editor. And this was truly the greatest class I've ever taken. I mean, you get to see every part inside and out. And that's about the time I started my senior thesis. And that's what got me hooked. So she and I have stayed in touch, took my thesis to New York, got a fabulous literary agent, and we sold it to our first choice, the first place that we went, which was Workman. That's for a magic book. They're ideal. And, you know, we've stayed in touch since then. I thank her in the back of the book. And she asked me to come back this year and speak to this group of writers. These are young students, I believe high school age, and they have been privileged to have a week of courses and help with some great writing teachers. And tonight's the last night, so I'm going to do some magic and speak to them at their shindig in about an hour.
What are you going to tell them about writing and the effect that it's had for you?
Oh, it's an amazing skill to have. The thing that I've noticed, it comes in handy in almost every job I think you could possibly think of, is this. We are all, in some way, storytellers. We all find ways to tell stories. Now, that may not sound like a good fit for magic, but if you think about it, every magic trick is a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. Every magic trick has a problem and a resolution. There's drama along the way. There's twists, there's turns, there's unexpected things that happen. And good magic tricks work based on the same principle that good stories work. So, you know, you have these dramatic elements that come together that make sense. There's an internal logic for everything involved and everyone involved. And I learned all those things as it related to fiction. I just took it and put it into my magic. But in whatever you're doing, I think being able to recognize a good story and tell a good story is an unbelievable skill to have. If you have that skill, mm-hmm. Public speaking is a cinch, because every bit of public speaking is telling a story.
Do you do a column as well? What's your column?
Yeah,
about?
I do a column in Magic Magazine, and I contribute to other magazines. I've just contributed to something in Cosmo, believe it or not. But it was a fun call. But yeah, I write, this is my coming up next month is my 10th year doing the tricks in Magic Magazine, which is the biggest magic magazine. And I write all the tricks for it. And I believe, let's say 10 years, I must have started it at Ohio State.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from The Ohio State University with guest host OSU Professor Nicole Kraft and her guest Joshua Jay, author of Magic, The Complete Course. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch some of our interviews by visiting www.ohiochannel.org or by checking your local television listings for broadcast times on The Ohio Channel. Now, back to Nicole Kraft's discussion with magician and author Joshua Jay.
Where do you come up with your tricks? Where do you come up with, you talk about having this goal in mind that you want to be able, for me to be able to sign a card and have it appear across the room. Is that just simple brainstorming, or where do those ideas come from?
Yeah, I mean, they come from within, but that means they come from without. My influences happen because of things that I'm interested in. So I'm a huge movie buff. So movies inspire me all the time. Weird plot twists, the way movies are told, sometimes they're told backwards, sometimes they're told in flashbacks. Those all have a bearing on the tricks that I create. Mm-hmm. And the other big influence, I have a show that I do called Unreal, and I'm going to Vegas with it next in 2 weeks. And that show is all about the places I've been. And tonight, one of the pieces I'm going to perform in the big show is my sort of tribute to all my favorite places. So I have a bunch of cards selected, and I find each one in the style of the country. So for example, I know you have an affinity for France, mm-hmm. as do I, and I speak French. Magic in France looks totally different than magic somewhere else. It's, mm-hmm. it's a great, great feeling. And, you know, so I talk about French magic and what magic by shamans in the jungle look like, and that's, you know, those things all show up in my show.
What are the skills that you need? I mean, we don't really think of magicians as being, you know, physically one way or another. So what is it that a magician needs to have to be successful physically?
Well, when children ask me, you know, how can we be a professional magician, I always tell them this, and this isn't just some empty, you know, motivational speak, but the only requirement to being a great magician is a true passion for it. Because everything else follows with a passion. And I mean that. I mean, I know magicians in New York who do shows just sort of endlessly. Every night they're booked somewhere. And it's become a job. It's become a chore. Right. And their magic suffers. I get up every day. I can't wait to get up and read about magic. Then I start my day, which is my stuff. And then I perform in the evenings. And then to unwind at night, I'll watch clips of other magicians and fall asleep with a magic. You know, mm-hmm. it's all encompassing. It's my life. And so I love it. And that's, everything else falls into place. I know magicians without their, you know, the ability to see, without the ability to hear, a magician who's lost his hand. All these things can be overcome and surpassed, but only if there's a real passion. And I'm sure the same is true in anything.
You know, I said that we don't think of magicians one way or the other, but we do think of them as older than you. And,
yeah,
you know, historically speaking, but, you know, we've seen Chris Angel, we've seen David Blaine, we've seen lots of young magicians. And you mentioned in a quote that you thought youth was an advantage to a magician. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an advantage if you look at it the right way. I mean, it's all about relating to your audience. I mean, the experience of a magic trick happens in the spectator's head, not your hands. So one way that I found that I can relate to people my age is to be me. You know, they don't want to see some 50-year-old telling jokes that aren't funny and talking about, you know, cracking things that make no sense to us. But my audience, about my age, likes the kind of music I like, movies I like, watches the shows I like, goes to the places I like to go, and it fits. There's a connection there. I mean, magic is truly about reading people and connecting, and that's harder to do if there's a huge age disparity. Not impossible, but in that sense, youth can be a real advantage.
But they also maybe have a different degree of cynicism than we used to, and you mentioned it about what we see in movies and with, you know, computer animation, the computer-generated images, all of those things. How do we keep them interested in magic or to believe in the illusion?
I think it's just to make it relatable. I mean, the kind of magic that I do, there is no CGI that can duplicate that because it's close up, it's with you know, an ordinary pack of cards and borrowed objects. And those things are undeniable. And they're about moments, and people love to feel those moments. You want to feel one of those moments?
I would love to feel one of those moments right now.
Have you seen a lot of close-up stuff?
I have not, except the videos I've watched of you.
Of me, okay. Well, this one you won't have seen. Watch me carefully. Just make sure I don't do anything. Not that part. That's just me taking out the jokers. Play fair. All right, you get to remember two cards for everybody at home. Go like this with your hand and put your thumb on top, just like that. First one you get to remember is the Ace of Hearts.
Ace of Hearts.
So I'm going to put this in your hand without looking. What card would you say that you're holding?
I would hope it's the Ace of Hearts.
Show it to him if you don't trust me. She doesn't trust me. Beautiful. Okay, next is the Ace of Diamonds. That's the next one you have to watch. Now watch here. Without peeking, this time, no peeking at home either, which card would you say that you have?
I would say it's the Ace of Diamonds.
You would say it's the Ace of Diamonds.
I would say that.
How about now?
The Ace of Hearts.
You're doing great.
The Ace of Diamonds and the Ace of Hearts.
That's right. I'll tell you what, let's start over. Turn them over. Let's start over those. Take a look. Those are the jokers. I thought we took those out. Pretty strange. Let's try something else. Hold out your hands like this. You'll be kind of like a makeshift table for me. There are different ways that performers try and find four aces, for example. Like, you've heard of cutting four aces, right? Well, before we do that, I'm going to mix face up into face down in your hands so that we have some toward the ceiling and some toward the floor. Some up, some down. Keep your hands just like that. I'll try and find the first one here. See, in Stockholm, Sweden, they work very neatly. That's the first ace.
Okay.
Try it again. In France, they do it more with a flourish like this. That's the second ace. Third one, we'll find it the way they find it in Vegas. They would deal the card, but since it's not on top, I have to do what's called a center deal, dealing it out of the middle of the deck, which leaves just one ace
the
left.
Anticipation.
Watch carefully. Last one. You get to turn it over.
That's
what do you
amazing.
Got? Yeah. All right. Cool.
Very impressive.
Well, I'll tell you what. One time somebody said to me, yeah, but can you do that with my deck of cards? And I said, sure, I can actually do that with every deck of cards I've ever used. Take a look. Every card in the deck changes color. Every single pack, even the back of the aces changes.
Wow. Joshua, yeah, I'm speechless, and that rarely happens to me, but I can't tell you what a pleasure it has been to be here with
you
and to welcome you back to Ohio State.
Thanks so much.
And we can't wait to see you perform magic again.
Thanks a lot.
OSU creative writing student Derek Palacio joins us once again to give his views on a recent release.
It is a necessity of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream that the human characters stumbling through the play's ethereal events be interchangeable. Their compatibility serves the comedic as well as thematic aims of the drama, calling attention to the flippancy of attraction while also challenging the very notion of true love. Chris Adrian's newest novel, The Great Night, begins on a comparable note of character similitude, his three human protagonists all heading toward the same party at nearly the same time via the same San Francisco park, each of them severely brokenhearted. Subsequently, the three mortals find themselves entangled in the same supernatural catastrophe, a calamity rooted in the grief of Queen Titania, a fairy goddess suffering the recent loss of both a mortal boy she'd come to love and her husband Oberon. The immediate consequence of her grief is the freeing of Puck, who in Adrian's telling is a mischievous spirit ravenous for mayhem. So begins Chris Adrian's impressively reimagined version of Shakespeare's original comedy, and so begins his attempts to bring these two worlds together, to twist the storylines into a tightly woven, evocative braid. Yet, as Adrian's novel is no drama, it does something Shakespeare's play does not, which is to quickly move toward the particular and specific. Adrian devotes the majority of his 300-plus pages to demonstrating exactly how the human protagonists, Molly, Will, and Henry, are distinct people suffering distinct pains. That character development takes the form of lengthy sections of flashback, all intended to lead the reader up to the current moment of crisis while subtly revealing the ways in which Molly, Will, and Henry are tangentially connected. The individual histories move forward beautifully and effortlessly, coloring characters in a way that drama can't, and only novels can. At the same time, they provide a welcomed, weighty counterbalance to the novel's sometimes comic nature. These characters suffer not only in the fairy world, but in the human world as well, and so the stakes are as emotionally tangible as they are poignant. If there is a downside to Adrian's approach, it is felt in the dramatic presence of the story, the actual Great Night, where those significant pasts remain submerged beneath the drunken stupor of fairy liquor and magic. Molly comes closest in allowing her anguish to influence or affect the events of that strange evening, but on the whole, she, Will, and Henry bump into one another without understanding or revelation. They are the pawns of the fairy world, and despite the lengths Adrian goes to in depicting their troublesome backstories, their pains prove trivial in the face of the supernatural crisis at hand. Like Shakespeare's transposable depictions, Adrian's structure comes at the cost of character authenticity. The playwright's comedy depends upon the exploitation of Lysander and Demetrius, caricatures of human desire, and so they are doomed to blank distinction as Athenian men. Similarly, the present tense sections of The Great Night, in order to strike a humorous tone, belie and debase the complexity of its human protagonists. Adrian seems to undo his own gorgeous work, the drama in progress diminishing the characters he spent so much time giving full form to. What The Great Night truly seems to be, rather than a re-envisioned Shakespearean play, is a beautiful, ghostly meditation on grief and loss. And this is why Adrian's finest work is found with Titania, the goddess whose pain is the most gripping amongst the players. What Adrian accomplishes with this demanding, majestic fairy queen is to reaffirm a bit of pride in the power and force of human love. Titania's own flashback to the hospital where her child was sick, to the moments when she and Oberon fought over the boy, to the boy's tragic mortal end, first appeared as a masterfully crafted and standalone story called A Tiny Feast in The New Yorker, and highlighted the best of this novel. The scenes in and of themselves are intentionally familiar in their sentimental circumstance, which affords Adrian the opportunity for character nuance, which in turn make a complex, intimate woman out of a distant, removed mythical figure. Titania is, of course, humbled by her loss, but Adrian's careful attention to the flavor of Titania's naive agony render this recognizable situation new and fascinating. An audience can disregard the fall of the mighty and instead empathize and commune with a bereaved deity. And that is conceivably Adrian's ultimate aim, to explore the liminal space between grief and salvation, the shadows between loss and redemption. The world of Buena Vista Park on this night is a mixture of the tangible and the airy, is a passing landscape that will go with the moon and fade with the hours, is a place both humans and fairies must venture into and out of, and Adrian is in full control of that reality. Perhaps it is his background as a fellow in pediatric hematology oncology, or perhaps it is his previous experience in writing about hospitals and doomed youth, A Better Angel, the Children's Hospital. But regardless of what, Chris Adrian understands better than most the notion that all love is precious, and mortal or immortal, one always suffers the cost.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, with guest Joshua Jay, host Nicole Kraft, and reviewer Derek Palacio. For more of our guests, visit www.writerstalk.org. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch some of our interviews either at www.ohiochannel.org or by checking your television listings for broadcast times. For signed books and interview DVDs of select Writers Talk guests, visit the Writers Talk section of the Ohio State University Bookstore. Join me next week for Rick Ellis, co-author of the musical Jersey Boys, which is playing in Columbus August 17th through September 4th. We'll talk about how the idea for the musical originated and how he worked with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons to craft it.
There's a computer program that you buy called Plot Perfect. And it's about, I think it's $18, and you put it into your computer, and a musical comes out. It's fantastic.
That's impressive. I would have thought it would have been musical perfect.
Yeah, but, you know, it's always the plot. It always comes down to the plot, especially when, you know, we were blessed to have the music in advance.
Girls, don't cry.
Said they don't cry.
Next time on Writer's Talk. Until then, this is Doug Dangler from the fourth floor of Mendenhall Labs on the beautiful campus of The Ohio State University. Keep writing.